Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA. The tails of their P-51 Mustang fighter planes were painted a distinctive red, and of course the flag they defended was red, white, and blue. But the faces of the pilots were black, and it was that fact which meant that the famed Tuskegee Airmen would fight their war on two fronts, in the skies of Europe, where their bomber escort group was the only one never to lose an escorted bomber to enemy fire, and in the minds of bigoted Americans who believed them incapable of this service to their nation. They succeeded brilliantly on both fronts. My guest is Ira O'Neill, who served as a first lieutenant with the Tuskegee Airmen and who frequently speaks on his experiences today. Mr. O'Neill, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
You know, I want to start with you helping us to understand the atmosphere, the history of the entire period we're talking about, because I think that most people listening to us really have no direct memory of the World War II era in America. Mm-hmm. And to gauge the accomplishment of the Tuskegee Airmen, we got to understand just how fierce the segregation and racism of the era were. So could you help us in your first answer just to get a sense of that?
Well, they required anyone that was going to Tuskegee have 4 years of college. Now, I don't know, and I've never heard what they required of the white fellows, but the black fellows had to have at least 4 years of college or experience in flying and all. Like Chief Anderson, who flew many years before World War II, mm-hmm. and many of the other fellows that landed down at Tuskegee were actually flying before World War II. They were flying between World War I mm-hmm. and World War II. Mm-hmm. And as far as the atmosphere, when the first class graduated, they graduated with five, only five. 13 started training, mm-hmm. and for one reason or the other, and we always say if the white instructors that we had down at Tuskegee, we used to say behind their back, if the wife burnt the egg, somebody's going to wash out. And so the first class that graduated with Benjamin O. Davis Jr. were five fellows
out of
13.
Right.
And they graduated in 1942.
So what you're saying is that even their instructors, in many cases at least, were an obstacle for them because the instructors didn't want them to succeed necessarily.
Well, if you had a instructor that came out of, say, Indiana or from the West or the Northeast, you had a fair chance. But if he came from the southern states, then you had a hard time. Yeah, and it was just the atmosphere was really rough at that time.
Well, that says a lot. Mm. Now, against that background, Ira O'Neill, help us to understand this, too, because within the African-American community, as I understand it, of that period, there was a very strong support for the idea of blacks in aviation. And as you pointed out in your first answer, there are a number of blacks had already been flying, including Bessie Coleman, the black woman
right,
aviator.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And in 1939, there is something that was formed called the National Airmen's Association, and I guess various other efforts. I guess what I'm asking for here, sir, is your idea of how the black community viewed itself in terms of aviation as a career. Was it enthusiastic for it? Did it want to see its men do that?
Yes, they did. The black community really wanted to, well, we were struggling from all angles. And when President Roosevelt started thinking of blacks flying, they didn't know where to train them.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln of Pennsylvania, Howard University, Hampton, Tuskegee, and West Virginia State.
Mm-hmm.
And those places were under consideration for training. And when they really realized what the problems here and there, then they decided that they would pick Tuskegee.
You know, there's something I want to ask you about, because you alluded to the fact, the obvious fact, the correct fact, that it was President Roosevelt who saw fit to encourage the establishment of the Tuskegee Airmen. I've always been curious about that, the origins of that, of how the idea developed. And I'd love to get your sense of it, you know, where, because it was against a lot of opinion in the country, opposition, not just opinion. And I'm particularly interested in the role that might have been played by Eleanor Roosevelt. Do you have any sense of that?
She played a large part in that. You know that President Roosevelt had infantile paralysis, and he used to go to Warm Springs, Georgia, for I didn't know about the hot water and all, but one trip that they took down to Warm Springs, Georgia, Dr. Patterson from Tuskegee invited Mrs. Roosevelt over to visit the school. And you've seen pictures and all about Mrs. Roosevelt flying with Chief Anderson. When Mrs. Roosevelt got over to the campus, they showed her around and all, and they mentioned Moton Field, and blacks were flying out of Moton Field, like Chappie James, who graduated right from Tuskegee and all. So Mrs. Roosevelt wanted to go over to Moton Field, and we laugh about it. When she met Chief Anderson, and Chief Anderson wanted to take her up, the Secret Service got between the, divided the airplane off, Chief Anderson off, and they called President Roosevelt and said that, I don't know how the conversation went, but I have an idea, but I won't speak on the air. But anyway, when the conversation was over with, President Roosevelt said, let her grow up. They're not going to eat her. So she went up with Chief Anderson, and Chief Anderson flew her around for about 20 minutes, something like that. And then when she got landed and got back to the president, the president, she told the president that they can fly. And from that way on, then he started backing the different places that I named earlier for training, and then they finally ended up down at Tuskegee.
That is a great story. I'm really glad you told us that. Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. And my guest today is Ira O'Neill, who served as a first lieutenant with the Tuskegee Airmen. Mr. O'Neill, as you know, I had the privilege of speaking with General Benjamin O. Davis some years ago, who commanded the unit and gained great and deserved fame himself. And he described a great many of their extraordinary exploits in the air. I'd love to get your sense, even a brief sense, of how you personally regarded the performance of your own unit, how you personally thought they performed.
They performed excellent. The, as far as the training, as far as the eagerness to learn how to fly, It was outstanding. Mm-hmm. The fellows that supported us, you know, for every pilot, there was either 10 or 11 people that touched that, had something to do with that pilot getting off the ground and all. And as far as the commanders were concerned, as far as the eagerness of the cadets, I feel sorry. We have, they say, 900 and about 96, almost 1,000 graduated. But it's more than that, that for one reason or the other, did not make the program. The ability to fly, because we said that you flew by the seat of your pants in those days. The program was excellent, and the fellows that exist now, we are about 500 officers and enlisted that are living today, and we have 45 chapters throughout the United States.
I want to talk about that very group, your group today, and what they're doing. But before turning to that, I want to focus on your career as kind of a bridge between your early service with the Tuskegee Airmen and your long career with the Air Force. And let me focus on this question, because the Tuskegee Airmen not only had a brilliant performance in World War II, but even after the war and things like the gunnery competition in 1949, the 332nd Air Group, which is a successor group, won that championship. Mm-hmm. And so you see, I guess the point I'm striving for is the Tuskegee Airmen did more than help win World War II. And I want to get your precise idea, because you stayed in the Air Force, as to what contribution they made to the whole idea of military integration.
Well, I think that integrating the service, when President Truman took over after Roosevelt passing, as far as the integration of the service, he integrated the service, you know, that, and then when even the enlisted men went to Japan, Alaska, Europe, Italy, all over the world.
You mentioned there are about 500 Tuskegee Airmen still active in society and still united as a group.
Right.
What kinds of things are they doing these days? I mean, what do they activities?
The one thing that each chapter does is that they give scholarships. The chapters give either 10 or 15. It all depends on the size of the chapters. Mm-hmm. And then we have a program called Youth in Aviation. And if a youngster that is in high school, the junior or senior, that wants to fly, we have a program that elevates you up to actually flying. We use College Park in Maryland, and I was trying to think of the name of the fella that Nelson Evans is in charge of the Youth in Aviation program. And several of the chapters throughout the United States have a program that backs Youth in Aviation. And then we speak because as far as history is concerned, a lot of young youth don't realize our contribution to World War II and integration.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because as we get to the conclusion of our program, I want to focus on that right now. And you've just said a lot of youth don't know the contribution of the Tuskegee Airmen. Are you speaking of our entire youth profile in this country, African American and others,
mm-hmm.
who are?
Yes. They don't realize that the contribution that we made as Tuskegee Airmen, because an incident in World War II, I don't know how many of you have seen the movie, The Tuskegee Airmen Story, and it's true that when B.O. Davis tolerated no foolishness, and behind his back we used to say that he slept at attention, but he was a disciplinarian from the word go, and we appreciate it now. We didn't appreciate it. We didn't appreciate it at the time that he was the CO, mm-hmm. but we appreciate it now, because the things that he instilled in us, that he got out of West Point, that we didn't realize because we were young and thought we were hot stuff and all like that. But now that we are older and all, then we appreciate what he was trying to tell us, as far as you got an education, take advantage of it, don't be foolish and all. And I appreciate it so, because I thought he was meaner than my dad. And my father was real mean, mm-hmm. because he was a policeman
mm-hmm.
for 25 years in Phoenix, Arizona. And I thought that my dad was the roughest guy until I got under B.O. Davis.
But Benjamin O. Davis, as you yourself, sir, have just pointed out, he was a monument, wasn't he? Of a man.
Oh, yes, yes.
Man.
Yes, everybody that served under him appreciates him now. But as I was saying, they were some mad at him mm-hmm. when on younger days.
Right. What happens when you bring this story, this great story, this great part of American history, to the attention, as you do in your speaking tours and appearances, particularly of young people? What kind of reaction do you get?
Oh, the silence.
Really?
Just silence. I spoke in Centerville 3 months ago, and the majority of the students, the student body, was white. They had about 10-12% black, and they had about, I'd say in the neighborhood of 800 students. And the silence that I got, it amazed me. And then I have a question and answer session, and the principal said 10 minutes, and they were asking me questions that I didn't think that they would understood and all, and we expanded it for 20 minutes.
That is very impressive.
Right.
I mean, first of all, that silence suggests they were literally in awe.
Oh, that is right.
The subject.
That is right. The silence mm-hmm. of that. And you know Centerville, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the high school there. And I don't. But getting back to your question, the young people, when we tell the story, because I usually have a little film that I have about 15 minutes, and that takes them back then. And then when I talk, I divide the subject into two areas. I talk about our experience in Tuskegee Airmen. Mm-hmm. Then I talk about how important it is for you to get an education.
Right.
And in that vein, I have the tension, and they're just whims. Just
well, you know, that's interesting, really, because that speaks to the power of the example even today. Because some time ago you made the point about how the example helped the military and the President Truman develop its integration policies.
Right.
But I think this suggests that the same power of the example exists today.
Right.
There's one question, though, that does occur to me as we talk about these things, and that is, do you think our history, the way we teach American history now, is adequate to this subject? In other words, it's striking that the students would be in such awe, but it also suggests that they hadn't heard it before, that somehow American history, as it's being taught generally, may not be giving proper due to the performance of Tuskegee Airmen and other...
No, it isn't. Mm-hmm. I can emphatically say no, it isn't. I don't know what it would take to get... we talk about the days of when they first discovered America and all, and right on up to, oh, say, the First World War. And then something, a variation of the history and all, that not only of blacks, the Tuskegee Airmen contribute, but blacks, period. I was talking about Benjamin Banneker, right down here on East George Avenue. And a lot of the youngsters didn't even know who Benjamin Banneker was. And not only majority of the whites, but a lot of the blacks didn't know what Benjamin Banneker, and the way the subject came up, we played a football game, the Tuskegee Airmen, in 1944 at Old Griffith Stadium on George Avenue. And we stayed at Benjamin Banneker Recreation Area across the street. And a young fella asked me, who was Benjamin Banneker? And when I got through explaining who Benjamin Banneker was and what he contributed and all, just told me that even black does not know the history.
Right.
So in that vein, the approach to what Negroes have contributed to the betterment of this country is falling short. And it amazes me all the time when I speak. And then I mention a name, and they ask me, who was that individual and all.
Well, that's an excellent, mm-hmm. that's a powerful statement. And mm-hmm. actually, it brings me right to where I wanted us to be as we conclude this conversation, because given what you have said throughout the conversation, and particularly what you have just said about the deficiencies in teaching the history of African Americans, do you feel that... a measure that's now, as I understand it, pending before the Congress would be a big help. I'm referring to a resolution that I believe that Charles Rangel of New York has introduced to provide a congressional gold medal to the Tuskegee Airmen. First of all, what do you think of that, and what effect do you think it might have on this question of making their contribution known?
Well, from where I sit... give us honor, but anyway, I don't know. I attended a fair in November on the Hill, and I got mixed opinions, and I'm still at a crossroad as far as what to say, but being a Tuskegee Airman and all, and I went through a lot of prejudice and all, and I would just say, give it to us and get on with the business of the thing. But it is a lot of controversy, and I appreciate Mr. Rangel doing that. But it has a long ways to go.
A long ways to go. But I think the main point you want to emphasize is that, regardless of that particular initiative, what's most important is that people understand the story.
Yes, that is right. Airman. That is right. And what we contribute to the, not only the World War II, but an American, just what we contribute to it. We are just, I think about going out to George Washington's home and finding out how the slaves discovered a lot of things, and George Washington took credit for it and all. Mm-hmm. But it's something. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You want the contribution understood.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly helped us understand it here today, and I thank you very, very much for
it. Well, it's a pleasure. All right.
My pleasure. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Ira O'Neill, who served as a first lieutenant with the Tuskegee Airmen. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.